Welcome to the Chilean Sea Blob Podcast. In each episode, I'll share a previously published short fiction written by me, Theodore Carter. The stories will slither in and out of genre distinctions, but will consistently stay weird. Now, let's get started with today's story. Max's Colossus Proboscis. Before I begin this story, please try to understand how difficult it would be to live with a hypersensitive sense of smell. The scent of wet dogs a half mile away, septic tanks littering the neighborhood, flatulence and body odor wafting from all directions. These are a few of the most common complaints I hear from my patients. I've witnessed the anguish this ailment can cause, and for that reason, it didn't surprise me when 18-year-old Max Pete flew across the country from Lakeview, California to my Washington, D.C. laboratory seeking my advice. I'm the best olfactory doctor in the U.S. Lorraine led Max into my office and sat him across from me. It was January, usually my slow time of year, when snowfall and frost bury many offensive odors. Max behaved like a springtime patient. He leaned forward, his elbow on his knee, his chin in his palm, and his hand covering most of his face. The boy's meek mannerisms made me rethink the intimidating formality of the wood-paneled walls, red pine bookcases, and gold-framed diplomas that constituted my decorating scheme. He hooked a worn Nike around the leg of his chair as if to brace himself against the coming Inquisition. I spoke the same lines I always do to new patients. It was only Max's half of the conversation that was out of the ordinary. "Maximilian Pete," I said. No response. "I understand you believe yourself to have an overactive sense of smell." His face was still pointed downward, but the bob of his head suggested he was nodding in affirmation. "Well, you've come to the right man, Max. I've treated lots of patients like you. Are you smelling many things right now?" Again, he nodded, his shiny, overgrown bangs bouncing. "Max, you may put your nose plugs in. I won't be offended." It's been my experience that patients with overactive olfactory glands carry a pair of nose plugs to wear when it's socially acceptable. I always invite my patients to use them as a way to demonstrate the depth of my understanding of their condition. It usually impresses them. "I already have them in," Max said. Though it was perhaps a bit callous of me, upon hearing Max's answer, I became instantly excited about the extent of his ailment. I envisioned a groundbreaking article in the International Journal of Smell Research. I wanted to help the boy, of course, but for years I'd been waiting for the ideal patient, one with symptoms so severe he'd react to every olfactory test in my barrage of patented procedures. While you may be appalled to read of my ambition in the face of Max's agony, you must realize every physician at the top of his field, perhaps even your own doctor, is waiting for a case like Max. Deformities are opportunities. I pulled my tape recorder out of my top desk drawer, pressed the record button, and said, "Max, why don't you tell me when you first felt there might be something abnormal about your sense of smell?" Max lifted his chin and gave me a hard stare. I had no doubt this gesture was meant as an expression of discontent, but his look also provided me with a glance at the inflamed cartilage of his nasal septum. The size of his nose clearly qualified him as disfigured, rather than simply unfortunately proportioned. On the tip of his nose, I noticed a small pimple, and its appearance reminded me of the boy's fragility. Inside Max's nostrils, I saw what looked like a custom-made skin-tone plastic plugs connected with a U-shaped bar. He jolted me out of my trance when he said, "I don't want to speak into the tape recorder. I'm not a lab rat." Max squirmed in his seat as if awaiting the backlash of his defiance. I was humbled by the severity of Max's case, as well as anxious about his delicate emotional state. For the first time in years, I wondered if I was in over my head. Self-doubt swept through me in the form of nausea. The acid from my morning coffee swirled in my stomach. Dreams of leading-edge research papers gave way to concerns about simply conducting a proper doctor-patient interview. I'd have to continue delicately. I pressed the stop button on my recorder. While the absence of an audio tape was detrimental to science, it does save you from the curt and often foul language that would be revealed through a transcription. Instead of giving you Max's word-by-word retelling, below are the facts I've gathered from many interviews with the boy and his parents. The truth came to me slowly, piece by piece, and I have set it down here accurately as I am able. Max's story begins in the summer of his 18th year, a time when he considered himself geographically, psychologically, and chronologically caught in limbo between the humdrum high school existence and college life at UC Santa Cruz. He was sure college would change everything he didn't like about himself. While waiting out the summer, he made and saved money by working 30 hours a week at Baskin Robbins. There was also a girlfriend in the picture, more of an officially titled individual rather than someone with whom Max spent a great deal of time. She'd spent most of the summer traveling, so his best friend, Dwight, accompanied Max to such attractive locations as the Omniplex, Taco Bell, and Tower Records, and the video game venue. Painfully plain, I know, but the boy's uneventful existence was soon interrupted by his burdening sense of smell. It happened almost instantaneously. One day, while manning the ice cream parlor, Max realized he could clearly smell each flavor of ice cream. Without consulting the map of flavors by the cash register, Max led himself to the freezer containing the vat of vanilla bean, not for a minute confusing the distinct scent with that of the vanilla chip. Without searching for bits of marshmallow, Max could differentiate Rocky Road from the double chocolate fudge. When the afternoon sun drove masses of cranky customers into the shop, Max gracefully wielded his ice cream scoop like a dessert magician. I'm fairly certain this was the first time he was good at anything. Just a few days later, Max discovered the downside of possessing such a Herculean nose. When the store trash cans were filled to the rim, he'd catch from across the room the odor of rotting dairy. His nose alerted him when the milk murky waters in the scoop bucket needed changing. The smell of the mildew in between the floor tiles made him realize his half-hearted mopping had never quite done the job. With the passing of a few more days, he began smelling the salty, sweat-covered customers. The scent of scents drifted into his nostril each time he opened the cash register, dirty copper, zinc, and nickel coins, as well as paper bills. He detected the stagnant air floating across the counter each time a customer opened the bathroom door. At first, Max welcomed this experience, even with the malodors. He'd been yearning for something new. "It was like the first time I got high," Max told me, although he later admitted he'd never actually been high. Heightened aroma awareness was by far the most exciting thing that had ever happened to him. Max only became concerned a few days later when he noticed that his nose was also changing on the exterior. What the boy didn't know was that a regional secretion of growth hormone had stimulated the swelling of his olfactory epithelium. It's the same type of chemical secretion that causes gigantism. However, in Max's case, the growth fluid remained in and around his nasal passage. This abnormal growth was not limited to the olfactory epithelium and internal organs. It also infected the skin and cartilage cells in Max's nose. Slowly, Max's nose began to bulge from its normal size to the malformed construction he brought into my office. The tenderness and swelling Max had first noticed was budding growth. He'd ignored it as long as he could by writing off the soreness as a result of common allergies or perhaps a skin problem. To some degree, he'd convinced himself that his acute sense of smell was just another post-puberty body transformation, like the sprouting of chest hair. Deep down, he knew there was something severely wrong, but it took the big date with Isabel to convince Max that he needed medical attention. 3 days after Isabel's return from Paris, Max picked her up for their first date in more than a month. Something about the jaunt to Paris made her fancy herself mature, sensual, and sophisticated, characteristics for which Max was not prepared. They went to the Vienna buffet, and while eating their turkey dinners, Isabel told Max he had the temperament of a Parisian artist. Max was perplexed by her comment, and he could only assume she'd mistaken his silence for deep thought and gentleness. As a medical professional, I must add that Max's silence at the restaurant could have been his baffled reaction to the cornucopia of smells emitted by the extensive buffet. Even someone with an average sense of smell knows what it is like to walk into a smorgasbord and recognize the scent of mashed potatoes, hot turkey, roast beef, butter rolls, gravy, string beans, and the rest. I can only imagine what this experience was like for Max. At the conclusion of the meal, Isabel said she was through with American Hollywood drivel and suggested they skip the Omniplex and take Max's car to the scenic overlook off Route 22. This is the place in Lakeview where one can actually view the lake, although not at night. After dark, the destination becomes more of an excuse than a vista, I'm told. Driving toward the scenic overlook, Max was as nervous as he was excited about the inevitable groping. After parking the car, he had little time to worry about how best to proceed. As soon as the engine went silent, Isabel began touching and petting Max in ways the boy had previously only fantasized about. She whispered French into his ear and peeled off her clothes. While Max still claims he had previous intimate knowledge of the female body, I believe such an admission to be highly suspect. The only reason I'm setting this scene is because in order to realize how truly traumatic this experience was for Max, you must have an idea of the difficulty of the situation without any added complications. Max had to contend with all of the emotions associated with one's first sexual experience, plus the burden of his heightened sense of smell. This scene is integral to his case history. According to Max, the Civic became an airtight lockbox of stench. With Isabel's body close to his, Max could smell all of her ointments and lotions, shampoo, baby powder, perfume, and cinnamon gum. While at first these scents heightened Max's sexual appetite, he then detected less overt but more offensive odors on her body, such as alcohol-based acne medication, chalky makeup, sweat, and depilatory cream. After becoming aware of this second wave of smells, Max no longer envisioned Isabel as a beautiful Aphrodite. Suddenly, she was a sweaty teenager with bad skin. Startled into a new awareness, Max noticed other smells. The scent of the turkey dinner had seeped into their clothing. The sticky pleather of the car's seats gave off a strong synthetic odor. Worse, he could smell his own nervousness, a collection in the form of sweat on his cotton undershirt, and in the background, a primal scent of sexual arousal grew from their respective loins. Everything was vividly clear and, in turn, outright disgusting. Isabel, oblivious to Max's change in temperament, reached into her purse and pulled out a condom. According to Max, as soon as he heard the sound of Isabel tearing open the wrapper, he was hit with the medicinal smells of latex, spermicidal lubricant, and the package's foil lining. In addition to the dirty reality of Isabel's humanity and the absurdity of his physical location, Max was now forced to accept the clinical nature of his sexual encounter. It was too much. All of the smells, the harsh realities, swirled inside the poor boy's head until his body ceased to function in a way that would allow him to consummate his lust for Isabel. This was the beginning of Max's downward spiral. After that moment, not only was it impossible for him to deny there was something wrong with his nose, the trauma of the event had somehow awakened the extraordinary power of his sense of smell. Every locale was now filled with as many scents as the Civic that horrible night. There was no safe haven. His own bedroom was an unbearable source of odor, no matter how much he cleaned. All but the blandest foods were nauseating. Friends, family, and coworkers carried with them a personalized funk that drove Max into seclusion. He spent most of his time alone in the grassy hills surrounding Lakeview, where he would insert nose plugs, wear a surgical mask, and read comic books. If I'd known Max at that time, I would have told him that most truly gifted individuals live beyond the parameters and conventions of mainstream society. Van Gogh cut off his ear out of loneliness. Galileo was killed for his heretical ideas. I was once mocked for shunning the senior prom in order to conduct pheromone experiments in the garage. There is a cost for greatness, but, of course, that's difficult to recognize at the age of 18. Max's nose continued to grow, and it was only about 2 weeks after his date with Isabel that his parents took notice. They said nothing to the boy, thinking it was one final awkward growth spurt. Ed and Kathy Pete were a bit self-conscious about the size of their own noses, and though neither of them said so outright, each felt perhaps reckless breeding and not a medical ailment was the cause of Max's affliction. When September rolled around, Ed and Kathy drove Max to UC Santa Cruz, unaware of their son's medical problem. He'd been a bit testy of late, a bit aloof perhaps, but they thought he was just getting stir-crazy. The Peets were sure that getting Max out of the house and into the university dorm would help him get back on track. Max also enjoyed brief illusions of fitting in at college. With a campus so near the ocean, the cool Pacific breeze helped dampen the pungent odors and make Santa Cruz much more bearable than Lakeview. He even decided to attend his freshman welcome mixer, a radical departure from his previous antisocial mindset. Dress had become important to Max, given the off-putting appearance of his face. In hopes of drawing Max out of seclusion, Mrs. Pete had purchased him new back-to-school khaki shorts and a UCSC cap he'd pulled down low to hide his overgrown nose. With the smell of the ocean tickling his nostrils, Kleenex stuffed far enough into his nasal passage to avoid detection and the protective shadow of his cap's brim, Max walks into the courtyard of his freshman dorm with hope. His peers stood grouped around the garden sipping sodas and munching on tortilla chips. Max felt their eyes on him as he walked to the cooler and fished out a cherry Coke. But after he'd retrieved his beverage and staked out a spot under a eucalyptus, the onlookers had returned to their conversations. A young woman approached Max. "Hi, I'm Amber," she said. Max panicked. First, because Amber was beautiful, and second, because she was only about 5'2", which meant she had a clear view underneath his cap. Max looked at her carefully, checking to see if she was looking him in the eye or staring into the vast blackness of his nostrils. "I'm Max." "Hi, Max. Did you know our school mascot is a banana slug? Pretty weird, huh?" Max noticed that the red hair of her ponytail bounced when she spoke, as if to reinforce the enthusiasm in her high-pitched voice. "Yeah, I guess. Are you from California?" "I'm not. I'm from Phoenix. My cousins live in LA, though. Most people here are from California. I've talked to just about everyone but you, Max." As she began a monologue about her summer trip to San Diego, Max found it strangely comforting to be bothered by an auditory stimuli rather than by smell. Still, he was pleased to simply be outside talking with a beautiful young woman who didn't wear perfume or use scented soap. Although she told him she'd already spoken with everyone else at the party, Max imagined the other freshmen looking on with envy as he spoke to Amber. When Amber finally ceased, Max opened the flip top of his cherry Coke. He lifted the can toward his lips, a gesture he imagined he would repeat many times over the next year using Coors Light instead of soda. But as he took a sip, Max failed to account for the increased size of his nose. He bumped the top of the can with his enlarged septum and spilled soda down the front of his t-shirt. The liquid splattered against the pavement, causing others to turn and see Max covered in cherry Coke. Anyone who has ever been to a cocktail party knows how a good joke can stimulate conversation. Max, standing under the eucalyptus, his new clothes covered in soda, served as the perfect icebreaker for the crowd of nervous freshmen. They laughed uproariously, according to Max, and it's not hard for me to imagine that they probably laughed more heartily than the situation dictated. While another young man may have smiled and shrugged, endearing himself to the other newcomers, Max was in such a fragile state that he immediately burst into tears. Amber tried to comfort him and began dabbing his shirt with her napkin. "It's all right, Max. I can get you a straw." But the damage had been done. 2 days later, someone crossed out the Pete on his dorm room nameplate and replaced it with Beak. Max's parents didn't know anything was wrong until late October when Max burst through their front door unannounced, carrying an overstuffed backpack and a small suitcase. Entering the foyer, Max sank to the tile and began crying uncontrollably. He was wet from the rain and wild with rage. The entire Greyhound bus ride, he'd only wanted to be somewhere familiar, somewhere where the smells, however awful, were at least predictable. Finding safety in his parents' home, Max's sobbing escalated into unrestrained wailing. Mrs. Pete admitted she couldn't even ask him what was wrong. Her attention was stuck on his malformed nose, which by this time had grown even larger. It didn't look natural, almost like a prosthetic, Mrs. Pete would later report. With her boy collapsed in a defeated ball of angst in front of her, she could only think, "Is this really my son? What's happened to him?" The poor woman was stupefied by his deformity. It was Mr. Pete who walked in from the living room, kneeled down, and said, "What is it? What's wrong, son?" Max's body shuddered with deep sobs. He raised his head so that his enormous nose was just inches from his father's. Max mustered a look of extreme seriousness, but could not altogether quell his tears. "Chili powder and feet! My roommate smells like chili powder and feet," Max said. The next day, Max officially withdrew from UC Santa Cruz. He moved back in with his parents and began the circuit of doctor visits my patients usually go through before they come to see me. "Now you know everything," Max revealed to me during our first conversation, "plus a bit more." After hearing his story, I took him to the examination room. I knew Max had an enlarged olfactory epithelium before I shone my light into his nostrils and probed his proboscis. It was the only plausible explanation. The examination simply helped quantify his ailment. Max's epithelium measured a full 40 square centimeters, larger than the smelling organ of a bloodhound, larger than any hypersmeller I'd ever seen. I'm a scientist, so attaching a measurement to the severity of Max's ailment filled me with a grave sense of responsibility. I realized Max must smell so well that he has a type of sixth sense, an ability to detect slight changes in human emotion, a coming summer rainstorm, the subtleties of an exquisite cuisine, and many other things most people can't even fathom. What wondrous aromas must make their way daily to Max's olfactory receptors? I was sure that by concentrating a little bit, Max could detect the smell of baking bread from nearby houses, fresh herbs in the neighboring backyard, or the pine forest on the outskirts of town. The medical profession takes great pains to preserve eyesight and hearing, yet little attention is given to smell. Is it any less important? It has been proven that it is smell we remember, not sights or sounds. Have you ever returned to your old schoolyard only to find it a miniature version of the image held in your mind? But you never forget the smell of the powdered lemonade your mother brought to the beach or the scent of your favorite home-cooked meals simmering on the stovetop. The boy's ailment was surely as much a gift as an affliction. His condition was the olfactory equivalent to X-ray vision. I sat the boy down in my office once again. We were in the same positions, me behind my large wooden desk and Max slumped in his chair, blonde hair covering his face. I told him, as I've already told you, of the localized secretion of growth hormone that was causing both his nose and internal smelling organ to increase in size. "That's why I can smell everything?" "Yes, Max." "Can you make it stop? Can you make me normal again?" I paused, knowing the statement I was about to make would be brash, beyond the confines of professional conduct, and perhaps a bit selfish. "Yes, I can do that, Max, but I want you to think hard about this. You have the most incredible sense of smell I've ever encountered, perhaps the greatest smelling power of any human who has ever walked the earth. And that's why I can't be near anyone or anything? What do you have to do to fix it?" "Now, Max, I can do that, but I want you to think first about what you're giving up. There has to be some upside to your condition, right? Can you not detect things before you see them? Like someone about to come around the corner or perhaps a cool stream beyond the next hill? It's like everything is on top of me at once. I can't stand it. Even now I can't stand it. Your dusty books, your old man aftershave gel. But there must be some good smells too, right?" Max was now visibly shaken. He held his hands and fists on his thighs. At this point, I believe my frustration overran my professional decorum. I kept prodding, fearing the boy would flee and leave me full of questions. Can you not detect human emotion, the changing body chemistry that comes with fear, anger, happiness? It must be like reading minds. But there are too many smells, too much going on, and the smells get jumbled around. I inhale these things that don't have anything to do with me. I want to be rid of it. I want to smell food and perfumes like a normal person, not body fluids and nasty things miles away. I want you to fix me. With this final comment, Max punched his thigh and looked into my eyes with a new seriousness. I knew our conversation was coming to an end. If I pushed harder, I would be testing the boundaries of medical ethics. Still, I could not give in entirely. I told myself my advice would benefit Max, that given time, he would learn to embrace his astonishing abilities. However, in retrospect, I believe I was acting upon an ambiguous obligation I felt that extended beyond Max. Maybe it was a duty to science or to humanity, or more likely, an unforgiving curiosity that made me want to know just what was possible. Max needed to be pushed, convinced. 4 weeks, Max. Give it 4 weeks. I'll provide you with treatment. In the meantime, I want you to fly home and think about the benefits of your condition. Consider what it would be like to master the most sensitive sense of smell the world has ever known. In the shadows of his swollen nose, I saw tears welling in Max's eyes. He stood up and walked swiftly out of the room. If he were more courageous, I believe the young man would have screamed at me, or perhaps even thrown my silver-plated nose paperweight across the room. Instead, he showed his defiance by slamming my office door and leaving me with my dust-ridden bookshelves, wood-paneled walls, and gold-framed diplomas. Even after he'd left, I couldn't stop thinking about him. I tried to worry about my patient's personal welfare, but instead found myself continually returning to a more self-centered fear about whether or not he would choose to go forward with the treatment and destroy his extraordinary olfactory abilities. During the days after our encounter, I constantly wondered if his mindset had changed. I received an answer in the form of an email. It came from a UC Santa Cruz account, so I assumed he'd enrolled for the spring semester. The message read as follows. From mxpete@uc.santacruz.edu to nosedoc@hotmail.com. Subject, wish I were well. Nose doc, I don't know why you wouldn't fix my nose when I was in DC. Things are worse now, not better like you said. The parties here smell like sex, vomit, and beer. I can't go to my Spanish class because the room smells like French fries. You're right, though. I do have a bit of a sixth sense. I can smell the happiness emitted from people's bodies when I turn my back to leave. I'm a freak. I will gladly trade in my new intuition and superhero nose for a normal life. You may think you're so smart with your cautious approach, but you're not. I'll see you in 12 days, and when I come, I hope you're ready to fix me. Max. I was crestfallen. What I'd told Max about his near limitless potential was completely lost on the boy. My advice had only served to prolong his agony, and I knew his anger was justifiable. It would be impossible for anyone to convince Max of the benefits of his disorder. I grieved for the world's loss and harbored shame for my selfishness. He would be in my office for treatment in just a matter of days, not long enough for a radical shift in thinking or perspective. I couldn't bear to see the boy when he came back. I made up an excuse about a scheduling overload and had my colleague, Dr. Smithfield, perform the procedure, the injection of the anti-inflammatory, write the prescription for the pills that would halt the flow of growth hormone to Max's olfactory glands, and the referral to the plastic surgeon. Dr. Smithfield said it all went smoothly. He did comment on the severity of Max's disorder, but the extent of the boy's capabilities never occurred to Smitty. Unlike me, he wasn't burdened with imagination. I liked to pretend Max never came in for treatment, that he was roaming UC Santa Cruz campus, designing the world's perfect perfume, or wowing wine connoisseurs across the Sonoma Valley with his uncanny ability to state vintage years and storage methods without ever taking a sip. I pretended that because of his nose, Max was able to sniff out the perfect mate, that he was lucky in love, never thrown off guard, and successful in his career. I had many careers for Max. I made him a pastry chef, a fireman, a forest ranger, a psychologist, a florist, and an artist. I saw him graduating at the top of his class, accepting the Nobel Prize in middle age, and as alert as ever in his sunset years. But curiosity can ruin good dreams. 2 years after his treatment, I met up with Max. This kind of thing is frowned upon in my profession, but I could not help myself. I was in San Francisco for a conference, so I drove a rental car down to Santa Cruz. I had to know if he regretted it, if he missed anything about his extraordinary nose. I needed to know it was really over, to be reminded that it had happened, and that perhaps it could happen again, maybe to someone different, someone who could stand it. Also, there was part of me that wanted to put my guilty conscience to rest and make sure Max was okay after what I'd put him through. My offer for a free lunch was enough to coax Max into a rendezvous. We met at a Denny's, drank coffee, and stared at each other across an orange and brown table. Max was still skinny. His wispy blonde hair had grown long and wild, but most striking was the small button nose the plastic surgeon had sculpted onto the boy's face to replace his swollen snout. And pierced through his left nostril was a gold hoop. I stared at the new facial construction, at least as long as I'd first studied Max's overgrown nose. Max was surprisingly friendly. In fact, his demeanor was so amiable, I could only assume that the horrible attitude he'd exhibited before was simply a reaction to his medical condition. He acted as though our history was an unfortunate memory of his childhood, something that can even be laughed at in retrospect. Although I suspect the incident was far more than that to him, maybe it was too traumatic to relive with true seriousness. After I felt I'd let the right amount of time lapse, I said, "Do you ever miss it, Max?" "What, the super snout? No way, man. It was awful. I mean, really awful. After that night with Isabel, I thought I'd never be able to be with a girl again, you know? It was bad." Max held the syrup canister high over his short stack and let the contents ooze onto his plate. "But what about the good stuff? Discerning human emotions and smelling fresh-cut grass a mile away?" Max kept his attention on his plate. "It was cool sometimes, I guess, but I don't really miss it." I kept talking, but the boy seemed wholly devoid of nostalgia, devoid of curiosity, devoid of regret. My eyes focused back on his new nose and its jewelry. The conversation was running dry, so I resorted to an easy question. Acting like an old fool, as he might expect, I said, "By the way, nice ring you got there. What made you pierce my favorite sniffer?" "I don't know. I wanted to try something new. Just wanted to be different, I guess." I looked at my home fries in order to hide my dismay. The scent of the skillet fried potatoes, onions, and peppers drifted upward to my ordinary smelling organ, and I thought I could detect a hint of paprika. Without looking up, I could hear the sound of Max's cutlery scraping his plate as he sliced into his pancakes and devoured them without any thought. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's story. If you did, please leave a rating and a review. Also, please tell a friend directly. Personal recommendations help a lot. My main goal with this podcast is to grow an audience for future work, and it'd be great to connect with more odd people who like strange art. I'd love to connect on social media. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at TheodoreCarter2 or on Facebook with the handle at ChileanSeaBlog. This story and other stories in this podcast are part of my book, The Life Story of a Chilean Sea Blob and Other Matters of Importance. The book is available wherever books are sold online, and you can find links to all of my books on my website, theodorecarter.com. You can also find other things there, like videos of me making a giant cement eyeball or turning traffic boxes into robots. Music from this podcast comes from TMI Management. TMIMGMT.com. Thanks again for being here, and I hope you come again.